fortune and a household staff of three. The social circles in which he had tended to move, at Trinity and then at Inner Temple in his more recent years, had not at all the rigid aspect of the peerage, where one's history and context differed from the next man only in degree. Nevertheless, his education had made him insular, for it had taught him that the proper way to understand any social system was to view it from above. With his college chums, dressed in capes and drunk on Rhenish wine, he would defend the merging of the classes with all the agony and vitality of the young, but he was always startled whenever he encountered it in practice. He did not yet know that a goldfield was a place of muck and hazard, where every fellow was foreign to the next man and foreign to the soil, where a grocer's cradle might be thick with colour and a lawyer's cradle might run dry, where there were no divisions. Moody was some 20 years Balfour's junior, and so he spoke with deference, but he was conscious that Balfour was a man of lower standing than himself, and he was conscious also of the strange miscellany of persons around him, whose estates and origins he had not the means to guess. His politeness, therefore, had a slightly wooden quality, as a man who does not often speak with children lacks any measure for what is appropriate, and so holds himself apart, and is rigid, however much he wishes to be kind. Thomas Balfour felt this condescension, and was delighted. He had a playful distaste for men who spoke, as he phrased it, much too well, and he loved to provoke them, not to anger, which bored him, but to vulgarity. He regarded Moody's stiffness as if it were a fashionable collar made in some aristocratic style that was unbearably confining to the wearer. He saw all conventions of polite society in this way as useless ornamentations, and it amused him that the man's refinement caused him to be so ill at ease. Balfour was indeed a man of humble standing, as Moody had guessed. His father had worked in a saddlery in Kent, and he might have taken up that mantle if a fire had not claimed both father and stable in his 11th year. But he was a restless boy with frayed cuffs and an impatience that belied the dreamy, half-focused expression he habitually wore, and the dogged work would not have suited him. In any case, a horse could not keep pace with a railway car, as he was fond of saying, and the trade had not weathered the rush of changing times. Balfour liked very much to feel that he was at the vanguard of an era. When he spoke of the past, it was as if each decade prior to the present year was an ill-made candle that had been burned and spent. He felt no nostalgia for the stuff of his boyhood life, the dark liquor of the tanning vats, the rack of hides, the calfskin pouch where his father stored his needles and his awl, and rarely recalled it except to draw a comparison with newer industries. Ore, that was where the money lay, coal mines, steelworks, and gold. He began in glass. After several years as an apprentice, he founded a glassworks of his own, a modest factory he later sold for a share in a coal mine, which in due course was expanded to a network of shaft mines, and sold to investors in London for a grand sum. He did not marry. On his 30th birthday, he bought a one-way ticket on a clipper ship bound for Vera Cruz, the first leg of a 9-month journey that would take him overland to the Californian goldfields. The lustre of the digger's life soon paled for him, but the ceaseless rush and hope of the fields did not. With his first dust, he bought shares in a bank, built 3 hotels in 4 years, and prospered. When California dried, he sold up and sailed for Victoria. A new strike, a new uncharted land, and thence, hearing once again the call that carried across the ocean like a fairy pipe on a rare breeze, to New Zealand. During his 16 years on the raw fields, Thomas Balfour had met a great many men like Walter Moody, and it was a credit to his temperament that he had retained over these years a deep affection and regard for the virgin state of men yet untested by experience, yet untried. Balfour was sympathetic to ambition, and unorthodox, as a self-made man, in his generosity of spirit. Enterprise pleased him, desire pleased him. He was disposed to like Moody, simply for the reason that the other man had undertaken a pursuit about which he evidently knew very little, and from which he must expect a great return. On this particular night, however, Balfour was not without agenda. Moody's entrance had been something of a surprise to the 12 assembled men, who had taken considerable precautions to ensure that they would not be disturbed. The front parlour of the Crown Hotel was closed that night for a private function, and a boy had been posted under the awning to watch the street, lest any man had set his mind on drinking there, which was unlikely, for the Crown smoking room was not generally celebrated for its society or its charm, and indeed was very often empty, even on the weekend nights when the diggers flooded back from the hills in droves to spend their dust on liquor at the shanties in the town. The boy on duty was Mannerings, and had in his possession a stout bundle of gallery tickets to give away for free. The performance, Sensations from the Orient, was a new act, and guaranteed to please, and there were cases of champagne ready in the Opera House foyer, courtesy of Mannering himself, in honour of opening night. With these diversions in place, and believing that no boat would risk a landing in the murky evening of such an inclement day, the projected arrivals in the shipping pages of the West Coast Times were by that hour all accounted for. The assembled party had not thought to make provision for an accidental stranger who might have already checked into the hotel some half-hour before nightfall, and so was already inside the building when Mannering's boy took up his post under the dripping porch facing the street. Walter Moody, despite his reassuring countenance, and despite the courteous detachment with which he held himself, was nevertheless still an intruder. The men were at a loss to know how to persuade him to leave without making it clear that he had intruded, and thus exposing the subversive nature of their assembly. Thomas Balfour had assumed the task of vetting him only by the accident of their proximity, next to the fire. A happy conjunction this, for Balfour was tenacious, for all his bluster and rhapsody, and well accustomed to turning a scene to his own gain.
"Yes, well," he said now, "one learns the customs soon enough, and everyone has to start where you were standing, as an apprentice, I mean, knowing nothing at all. What sowed the seed, then, if you don't object to my asking? That's a private interest of mine. What brings a fellow down here, you know, to the ends of the earth? What sparks a man?"
Moody took a pull on his cigar before answering.
"My object was a complicated one," he said. "A matter of family disputation, painful to relate, which accounts for my having made the crossing solo."
"Oh, but in that you are not alone," Balfour said cheerfully. "Every boy here is on the run from something, you can be sure of it."
"Indeed,"